And from the KTOO Newsroom in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Krimery. The Juneau Assembly has authorized city staff to advocate for a new city hall. The Alaska Public Offices Commission requires the Assembly to appropriate funds through an ordinance if it wants staff to influence an election. If there's a question on the ballot again this year about funding a new city hall, this is the only legal way for staff to share information about the project. At a special Assembly meeting on Monday night, members authorized the city manager, Rory Watt, to spend $50,000 on the effort. Watt says City Hall needs several repairs and isn't big enough to fit all city staff.
We believe that a new City Hall is in the best interests of our citizens. And in the effort to provide information, we would be trying to influence the election.
Watt says the money would offset costs for existing staff to give presentations, post on social media, and advocate in other ways. The only new cost would likely be for postcards mailed to voters. Five people spoke in opposition to the spending. North Douglas resident Scott Spickler said voters already rejected the project when they voted down the City Hall bond proposal last year.
The project should stand on its own merits if you choose to put it on the ballot again, and I hope that you don't.
The Assembly still needs the vote to put the bond proposal on the October ballot. Members of the project of the public can comment on that at the July 10th meeting. And at least two Alaska Department of Corrections staff members have faced charges in recent months for bringing opioid addiction recovery medication into correctional facilities on the Kenai Peninsula. These cases, advocates say, could be related to gaps in treatment programs at Alaska prisons and jails. They say without consistent and long-term treatment options for opioid use disorder, there's a lucrative black market for medications in facilities where rates of substance use are disproportionately high. Sabine Pooks reports for KBBI.
In April, a correctional officer was charged for bringing buprenorphine into Spring Creek Correctional Facility in Seward. Earlier this month, a former staff member was charged for distributing Suboxone at Wildwood Pretrial in Kenai. Sarah Spencer says she isn't surprised these cases are coming to light. She's an addiction medicine specialist based in Inilchik, and she says buprenorphine is the gold standard for opioid use treatment today.
There is very few medications that we have in modern medicine that are as effective as this medication is to treat this disorder. It is just incredibly effective.
Buprenorphine is a prescription opioid that treats withdrawal symptoms and reduces cravings. Suboxone is its brand name version. Spencer's Inilchik Clinic offers injections of the drug for patients in recovery. But she says people in Alaska's correctional facilities often can't access buprenorphine or other drugs through in-house treatment programs, even though they're shown to be incredibly effective. Around the U.S., stigma and bureaucracy have kept states from implementing similar treatment programs at their correctional facilities. And that could be why correctional employees and inmates are smuggling those drugs in, and in those recent cases, getting caught. Symptoms of withdrawal can be brutal, including severe nausea and restlessness. And Spencer says going cold turkey can be really painful. She says it's like the worst flu you've ever had, times 10.
It's just incredibly painful in every way you can imagine. And so, of course, there's going to be an enormous black market.
Drug treatment policies vary from facility to facility in Alaska. As it stands, the Department of Corrections says it will bridge patients' medications for up to 30 days. That means inmates with methadone and Suboxone prescriptions, for example, should be able to keep on their treatment plans for a month after they enter the system. But Spencer says that doesn't always happen. She says the state's technically required under the Americans with Disabilities Act to continue incoming inmates on their medication when they enter the system, according to guidelines from 2022. And she says the inconsistent treatments could be a lawsuit waiting to happen. Some state facilities also offer injections of Vivitrol, an opioid antagonist that keeps cravings away, but unlike its counterparts, is not an opioid and does not block symptoms of withdrawal. Spencer says withdrawal is no joke. Symptoms can be so bad that they drive people to suicide. Adam Mahoney of Homer says that's why there's such a big black market for drugs like Suboxone in Alaska's prisons. He started using pills after a motorcycle accident when he was a teenager. After another accident in 2019, he started doing heroin. Last year, he was arrested and sent to Wildwood.
I knew that when I went to jail that I was going to be sick.
He says there was a really high value in Wildwood for smuggled Suboxone, so he brought in his own by swallowing a package of a couple dozen. But the pack exploded in his stomach, and he says he almost died.
It just kind of goes to show the extremes that we'll go to just to maintain adherence. It's really hard in jail to begin with.
Mahoney says he wasn't offered any treatment and went through withdrawal for about 3 weeks in jail. Luckily, when he got out, he was able to connect with Spencer and her team, and he says things are going great for him now. Spencer says she's working with the Department of Corrections to get more consistent systems in place for patients. DOC spokesperson Betsy Holly says the department's in the process now of expanding the treatment services it offers to go beyond 30 days in the case of inmates with existing prescriptions, in addition to starting patients on treatment while they're incarcerated. And some states do already have programs in place. Rhode Island, for example, has been offering medication for addiction treatment programs since 2016 at its prisons and jails. Spencer says the data shows it's working.
We know what works. We know exactly what works. We just need to do it.
She says in a crisis like this one, there's just no time to waste. In Homer, I'm Sabine Pooks.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration released an updated population estimate for Cook Inlet beluga whales, which offers hope for recovery. Since 1979, the belugas have seen a 75% decline. Historically, their numbers ranged around 1,300. By 2018, their numbers had dwindled to 279. But this year, they reached 331. As KNBA's Hannah Bissett reports, that's the first increase in decades.
The population estimate for Cook Inlet beluga whales has been delayed since 2018 due to challenges such as the pandemic and weather restrictions. It's finally been conducted this year, providing important information about the current status of this endangered species. There has been a recent positive development as the population has witnessed its first increase in estimation in decades. The population estimate pool has been raised by around 100 whales. According to NOAA biologist Paul Wade, the new development shows that the population is finally stable.
However, when we look back over the 10-year window, because 10 years gives us enough data points to make some sort of conclusive statement, it looks like it actually was declining and then increased, and then overall that evens out to being stable.
This change could be impacted by several factors, including, but not limited to, points of pollution and decreased noise pollution. The actual cause of the median increase is still being studied. As to get an accurate idea, you would need multiple years to showcase the incline. Reagan Davey is a chemist dedicated to advancing research and resources to enhance our understanding of Cook Inlet beluga whales. Davey emphasizes that a decade ago, a list of contaminants of the Cook Inlet was identified. There are hundreds of mixing zones that are approved for the Cook Inlet. However, the tests taken to showcase the pollution in the mixing zones have yet to yield definitive results regarding every impurity found in the area.
What I think would be great is if they did have to test for every contaminant, because then you could directly relate it to a source, but that's not how it goes. So, and they do issue and report what is over the limit. They don't have to test for everything.
Another concern that has come up recently has been the small population of beached whales with incomplete pregnancies with birth defects. But the amount is too small to have conclusive data. The incline of the median still needs to be thoroughly dissected to get a complete picture of how the belugas are truly doing. For KNBA News, I'm Hannah Bissett.
And the union representing Alaska's longshore workers reached a tentative bargaining agreement Friday evening following nearly 18 months of negotiations. The International Longshore and Warehouse Union Alaska Division said in a statement that it's still up to union members to vote for the agreement. The International Longshore and Warehouse Union represents nearly 30,000 workers across the United States, with around 350 members working in Alaska ports. The union says they won't release details of the tentative agreement with the public until after they've completed the ratification process. But they say their time at the bargaining table shows the importance of union members' hard work. The union's West Coast division recently reached a similar agreement for their 22,000 members. That comes on the heels of labor disputes, which led to the shutdown of cargo operations in Seattle. If ratified, the Alaska Longshore Division's new contract would apply until June 2028. And as for the weather, it's currently 59 degrees and overcast here in Juneau. This afternoon and tonight, there may be some rain on the way with a low of 54 degrees. Tomorrow through the weekend, it looks like it will be rainy with temperatures between 55 and 60 degrees. And that's all the forecast for the rest of the week. It's just about 5 o'clock. You're listening to KTOO.
Thank you.